From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. It's old-fashioned elbow grease for the online era. President-elect Barack Obama's blueprint to kickstart the economy calls for the biggest public investment in roads and bridges since the 1950s. But his strategy also demands a major renovation of the American information superhighway. He says it's unacceptable that the country that invented the internet is falling behind in the worldwide broadband race, and that we won't get our economy back on track if we don't get more people riding on the internet's fastest lanes. But it's going to take more than cranes and shovels to make top-flight broadband affordable and available to everyone. Joining us to explore what the new administration can do to get more people on board with broadband is Ben Scott, Policy Director at Free Press, which is a nonpartisan organization that advocates media reform and universal access to communications. Ben Scott, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Jim Saccone, Senior Executive Vice President for External and Legislative Affairs at AT&T. Jim Saccone, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here.
And those of you who'd like to join this Tech Tuesday conversation can call us at 800-433-8850 or send email to Kojo, that's K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org. What kind of broadband access would you like to see in your neighborhood during the next 4 years? 800-433-8850 is the number to call. This is the number that gets tossed around a lot, that the United States ranks 15th in the world in broadband penetration. What are the countries that rank ahead of the United States doing that we're not, Ben Scott?
That's a complicated question, and in many ways the $64 million question, or $600 billion question, exactly, depending on where you look for your money. They're doing a variety of things. I think that the countries that are leading the world in broadband adoption are in Europe, they're in Scandinavia, they're in East Asia, and they've done different things to get to where they are. Sometimes they do things that we can replicate in terms of, you know, putting public dollars into infrastructure, expanding access, putting technology training out into schools and libraries, getting people computers, putting more competition into the marketplace to drive down prices and increase speeds. Those are the kinds of tools that governments overseas have used to expand their broadband markets.
You know, those of us who are here would tend to think that in those countries, these are all the result of massive government intervention. Are they necessarily?
In some cases, they are. But in other cases, some of the countries that rank ahead of us in those rankings tend to be very high-density countries like Belgium and places like that that don't have the geographical challenges that we have here in the United States in getting service out to rural areas.
We've been hearing a lot about shovel-ready infrastructure projects lately, ways to kickstart the economy by repairing roads and bridges. But President-elect Obama also said this month that improving broadband access will be a key part of the economic stimulus package that he plans to introduce. What do you make of the parts of the plan that he's laid out, Ben?
I mean, so far, I think that what we've got is a statement of purpose and goals. He'd like to put a high-speed internet connection into every home in America. He'd like to have children have access to technology for their education, for economic development. I think that, you know, Jim and I and probably everybody shares that goal. The question is, how do you get there? And I think if you look around town over the last few years, I think there's a broad recognition that we have issues with broadband policy, we have issues with broadband deployment that we ought to solve. But really what you see is everybody agrees that broadband is great, and everybody agrees we ought to extend it to everybody, but then there's a big question mark in the middle. And that's, I think, the central challenge that we're getting at with the stimulus bill as a first step.
When you say there's a big question mark in the middle, what's the question before the question mark?
So the question mark is, how do you get from where we are today to what Barack Obama says we need to be? What kinds of policies do we need to put in place? Is it competition policy? Is it public investment? Is it cities getting involved in broadband access? Is it tax credits? Is it, you know, subsidies for consumers to buy these products? You know, what kind of tools can we use to get closer to that goal?
I guess another question is, where do we start? Some governors have already identified construction projects where they can put workers to use right away, but with broadband, where do you start? Where's the best place to start, Jim?
Well, I think everybody agrees, Kojo, that there are tremendous economic upsides to getting more broadband out there. There's a couple challenges to it, and they're not small challenges. We do have to recognize that we've not done a bad job in getting the basic broadband connections deployed across the country. Upwards of 85% of Americans today have access to broadband. The other 10 to 15% is hard to do. It's in rural areas. These are very expensive areas to build in, and so you have some technology challenges there. But the other end of the challenge is that the adoption rate is still not what we would expect where broadband access is available to people. For whatever reason, people that have it available have decided not to take advantage of it.
And I can tell you how important broadband has become to those of us who now have it. The headline that I saw on CNN.com yesterday that I'm reading today says, U.S. adults choosing internet over sex. Nearly half of the women aged 18 to 44 surveyed, or 46%, said they would rather go without sex for 2 weeks than give up the internet for the same amount of time. So you understand how crucial a service we're talking about here, Ben.
Well, in that case, then, the 40-plus percentage of homes that don't have broadband must be really missing out.
Either that or they're having a lot of you-know-what. The federal highway system is pretty expansive, but if you want to get out to a lot of the remote places in the U.S., you've got to hop on a state highway or even maybe down a run-down dirt road. What kind of public investment is it going to take for broadband to reach these remote corners of the U.S.? Let's start with you, Jim.
Well, I think we're going to have some enhancements to the concept of universal service and modernizing that. It's how we got the phone system and the interstate highway system and other things built in America, is that I think the government has recognized that our geography presents unique challenges. How we deal with the expense of getting these services into rural areas, and the government has come up with ways of either incenting or subsidizing some of those services. We currently have a universal service fund, but it's not geared toward broadband currently. It's geared toward traditional types of phone service, and we need to take a fresh look at the whole concept of universal service and whether we shouldn't be transitioning these subsidy mechanisms to incent broadband build-out in hard-to-serve areas.
Ben, what's the federal government going to have to ask from state and local partners in order to make this happen?
There have been a variety of proposals that have said, well, the federal government will put up a piece of the money, the state government will put up a piece of the money, and private industry will put up a piece of the money, and together that will make the economics work and the business model for rural broadband deployment. I think another thing the states can do and the local governments can do is they can tell us where the problems are. One of the big issues that we've been dealing with the last few years is that the federal government simply does not know where broadband connections are and where they're not. So we have no ability to target those subsidies right now in ways that are rational and accurate. We need to work with the locals who know absolutely, you know, that Joe down the street doesn't have broadband, but, you know, the houses up on the hill do. That's the kind of information that can be the difference between an effective program to get broadband deployed and a wasteful one.
Jim Ciccone, what is it going to take for the federal government to try to persuade private industry to go and take broadband into places where it is not profitable?
Well, I think that's a good description of the challenge in rural areas, and I think it's going to take some sort of either investment incentive or some sort of subsidy mechanism to incent that. I think it's also a matter of how you focus it. I think if there is a subsidy, I think that there's a lot of argument that it should subsidize not ongoing service but the basic infrastructure build, so it's a one-time subsidy, and I think that gives probably more bang for the buck than you'd get otherwise. And I think traditionally the government also looks at the tax structure when it wants to incent certain behavior in certain areas. It's done that with the research and development tax credits in order to deal with the problem in research investment in this country. And I think it could look to things like accelerated depreciation, things of this nature for broadband-related investments.
Outside of a philosophical commitment to public service, what is the basis of AT&T's support for universal broadband? What's in it for AT&T?
Well, first of all, we serve a lot of customers in rural areas, and obviously those customers want to be able to get those services, and we want to provide them, and we're looking at a lot of different ways of doing that. Currently, we deliver broadband service in a number of different ways, but for the most remote areas, right now, one of the only viable ways of doing it is satellite broadband. It works; it covers 100% of the country, but it's pricey. And some people can't afford it. We're very hopeful that the recent spectrum auction at the FCC, where we and a number of others purchased what was the old analog television spectrum, will allow us to effectively deploy wireless broadband in many of these hard-to-serve areas.
Ben, I know you want to weigh in on this issue, but since Jim brought up the issue of satellite, allow me to go to Heidi in Falls Church, Virginia. Heidi, you are now on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I guess I'm just a little frustrated because I have two nieces and a nephew who are growing up in the middle of Iowa, not too far from Ames, you know, a big university, but they're in Nevada, Iowa, in the middle of farm country, and they can't have internet access because their parents can't afford a satellite. And, you know, you've got three kids here that are growing up, you know, without, you know, a lot of the things that my kids take for granted because they live in the Northern Virginia area. And, you know, I feel horrible because my nephew, who's the oldest, has, you know, he ended up actually joining the military just so he could see something other than the middle of Iowa, you know, because he couldn't even see it at school. They don't have access unless they were, you know, doing research on a paper.
Well, so, allow me to have Ben Scott chip in now, because, again, it raises the issue of how you're going to get private companies to build infrastructure in places where it's not profitable to do so.
Well, I think that this example is exactly what we're talking about. This is about real people. It's about real people in their homes trying to raise their kids, trying to do their jobs, trying to build economic growth in rural America, which has long seen declines. And, you know, as a consumer advocate, I ask myself two questions when I look at these kinds of policies. Number one is, how can I get networks that are world-class into places where they haven't been before, like rural Iowa? And how can I make sure that people both can afford them, have computers, and know how to use them so that when we bring that technology, it actually works in their lives? So I think the questions we have to ask the Obama administration, the next Congress, is not just, you know, how do we convince Jim that we're going to give him enough money to make the business model work in rural Iowa? Although I don't think he serves rural Iowa, so I won't put him on the spot. You know, the second question is, how do we make sure that this money doesn't go the way the bank's stimulus package did? How do we make sure that customers actually get what they paid for? And in this case, the customer is a taxpayer, and that's that family in rural Iowa. I want that family in rural Iowa to be able to say, in 2 years' time, this worked. We now have a network that's as good as it is in Ames, and we can afford it. It's at a price that is reasonable, and now our kids have access to the same technology as everybody else in the country and can get those advantages.
Heidi, thank you very much for your call and sharing your story with us.
Sure, thanks.
You too can call us, 800-433-8850. It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on universal broadband access. What do you think the federal government could be doing to make broadband more available in the United States? 800-433-8850. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue this Tech Tuesday conversation. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Next time on Tell Me More, the recession has been hitting just about every corner of the American economy. The big banks have been much in the news, but what about the little guys? With big banks laying off thousands, we ask how small and minority-owned banks are faring. We'll ask a top banking consultant. I'm Michelle Martin. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's on Tell Me More at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet W.S. Merwin reads poems about memory and mortality from his new collection, The Shadow of Sirius. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
That's on Fresh Air, coming up at 3 on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the German Embassy and German Information Center, now celebrating the relaunch of its website, germany.info, offering more information on Germany, a new design, videos, games, and interactive features. More is online at germany.info.
SoftScribe provides copies of WAMU 88.5's top five most popular transcripts. More information is at WAMU.org under Programs or call 1-800-871-7072.
Let's return to the conversation on the Kojo Namdi Show.
We're having a conversation about universal access to broadband, high-speed internet, which President-elect Barack Obama says is one of the things he wants to make sure happens in an Obama administration. We're talking with Jim Ciccone, Senior Executive Vice President for External and Legislative Affairs at AT&T, and Ben Scott, Policy Director at Free Press, which is a nonpartisan organization advocating media reform and universal access to communications. We got this email from Terrence, who says, all of this talk about the necessity of broadband has me confused. How exactly are current broadband customers using their high-speed connections? YouTube? International phone calls to friends? Piracy? I'm one of those people who uses the internet primarily for email and newspaper articles. A telephone connection serves my needs at less cost with no long-term commitments. I visit my local library for high-speed access when necessary. What precisely do we want people to do with their faster internet connections? Ben Scott?
Believe it or not, you know, this is a question that I get a lot. I do a lot of traveling around the country and talk to people about the importance of universal access to the internet, and that question comes
this
up.
This obsession with speed, speed, speed.
Well, that speed translates into value, because the more speed you have, in short, the more cool stuff you can do online. So what broadband gives you is the intersection of two fundamental elements of any society, which is infrastructure, the network of communications, commerce, and political discourse, and two is the media system. You know, it's not going to be too long before every media outlet has a website, before every piece of content is archived online, before the internet and the distribution of bits on the internet becomes the fundamental infrastructure by which we communicate with one another as a society. So I think that it's more than just YouTube and the New York Times and your email. It's distance learning. It's participation in programs, e-government programs. It's helping your kids do their homework in the evenings when they come home from school with an assignment that requires the internet. It is job training. It is, and I'll give you a great example. I recently was in the used car market and did my homework online and did a ton of research and saved myself $2,000.
In addition to probably 4 or 5 hours at a dealership.
That's right. So I feel like, you know, I've paid my broadband bill for the next 5 years just in that one bit of research on auto sales. And if I had just walked in with no knowledge off the internet, I would have been disadvantaged considerably.
Jim Ciccone?
Well, I think Ben's absolutely right on this. There's two other things I think that broadband provides that are really, really important. I mean, first of all, I think the commercial aspects of this are pretty astonishing, and it isn't just the ability to purchase things over the internet and get a far wider range of goods that might be available that might not be available otherwise, but in many ways it allows people to start their own business at very low cost. You don't necessarily have the overhead costs. If you want to go into business, if you've got a good idea, you can go online and be able to set something up and have access to people throughout the world. There's one other thing that I think is really pivotal, and I think we don't consider this often enough, but it's what the internet itself has given us here, which is revolutionary in the sense that for the first time in human history, access to knowledge has been democratized. There's not a price tag to it anymore, other than a broadband connection. If you think about some of us growing up, where the sign of an educated family was when you spent the big bucks to get a set of encyclopedias or something like that, or to get an advanced degree, the internet for the first time has made the full range of the accumulated knowledge of civilization available to anyone to access for free, other than the cost of a broadband connection.
Allow me to go to the telephones. Here is Jennifer in Rappahannock County, Virginia. Jennifer, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just wanted to say a couple of things. I have dial-up, and there is some discussion in the county about putting in broadband, and I think that they can just save the effort, because if you want to work from home, you need to be able to encrypt what you're doing, and you cannot do that on broadband. If you have to work on a telephone that needs to be encrypted, you really can't do that on broadband. So it doesn't really benefit anybody that really wants to work at home secondarily.
Well, allow me to demystify this aspect of the discussion. It is not my understanding that you can't get encryption on broadband.
I think Jim could sell you a product right now that could encrypt all of your traffic coming out of your house. There are a variety of consumer encryption products that you can use as an individual, and virtually every corporate network that I know of is going to have an encrypted, what's called a virtual private network, which is essentially a tunnel through which all of your communications flow between you and the other people on that network over the internet.
Jim?
Right. There's actually, if you're just looking to secure your own communications, there's very good programs you can download right on the internet for free that are available, that are tested, that have been reviewed by all the reputable magazines and sources. But companies like ours who work with other companies help them set up what Ben referred to. It's a virtual private network. It allows you to basically log on to a company website, and everything is really carried separate from the public internet directly through proxy servers, so that you can secure that communication, and that's what really enables you to work from home in a secure fashion. I do it every now and then. I can access it from the road. It works very, very well, and it's within the reach of any small business.
Jennifer, you had another part to your question?
Yes, too. I guess I should have been more clear. You can't use your telephone you can't talk through the computer and carry on a conversation, is my understanding, with broadband. You have to have Fios. My second thing I'd like to say is there are people using broadband up and down my road, but you have to live on top of the hill. The same guy that can use broadband up the hill from me can't use it in my house because I got very excited. I thought, oh, I'll get to work from home and not commute. And by the way, rural for me is 1 hour west of D.C. Fiber is within 1 mile of my house, and we can't get it to come any closer.
Well, we'll
pay something like $300 per foot to have it laid in.
Jennifer, thank you for your call. We'll talk about that also, because more and more people are cutting out basic cable and network TV to watch their favorite programming online. How does AT&T, for instance, Jim, plan to compete against TV services like Verizon's Fios service, which Jennifer just brought up?
Well, we actually have a product called UVerse out there. It is IP-based TV. It's actually delivering television services over the internet, It certainly looks initially, I think, to some people like the channelized video they're used to with cable or satellite, but it really can be two-way. It can be interactive because it comes over the internet, and it would allow you, since it's IP-based, to also stream video directly from websites. So at our company, we're really embracing the internet. We don't view it as competition so much as an enhancement to the services that we offer.
The broader question, of course, Ben Scott, is how is this trend, more and more people watching their favorite programming online, going to affect the deployment of high-speed broadband infrastructure?
Well, that's a great question, and it cuts right to the heart of where we started, which is how do you incentivize the deployment of broadband? How do we get that fiber optic line that Jennifer was talking about from a mile away from her out to her house? Because really, all broadband is is a glorified telephone network. They're bringing a cable into your house and plugging it into your home system, and so it gets right into your computer. And that's what brings you that connectivity, whether it's a fiber optic line or a copper wire or a coaxial cable. It can all bring you access to the Internet. But what it also brings you is cable television, and it brings you telephone service. So when we say we're deploying broadband networks, Internet service is only one part of that. We're also bringing you cable television, and we're bringing you telephone service. So, you know, from my point of view, it's the Internet piece which delivers the economic and social benefits, not the cable television. But I suspect from Jim's point of view, it's the cable television that earns the greatest return on every dollar that goes into that network. So we have to constantly think about this equation when we're trying to figure out, you know, what is it that we're doing when we put public dollars into infrastructure? What is it that we're driving at when we say, hey, we want world-class infrastructure in every community in America, whether you're in Washington, D.C., or whether you're an hour away in Loudoun County?
You can join this conversation on Universal Access to Broadband on Tech Tuesday by calling 800-433-8850. Where do you think improving broadband access should fit into President-elect Barack Obama's plans to stimulate the economy? 800-433-8850. Here's Tony in Beltsville, Maryland. Hi, Tony.
Hello. How are you doing today?
I'm well.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
You know, I actually do work in the computer industry slash network security. And, you know, I guess I take having a broadband connection for granted because I'm still somewhat at a loss to see what are the real benefits that we would receive. I'd like to know if the speakers could maybe talk about the benefits that other nations have enjoyed as a result of public and private investment in their broadband networks, such as South Korea, China. I think you also mentioned Belgium. What are the gains that those countries have experienced in the last 10 years or so?
Ben?
So, I mean, there are a variety of benefits to what they have done. You know, the primary benefit is it costs less for more Internet access. So, for example, you know, here in the Washington, D.C. area, I pay about $50 a month for about 10 megabits of speed. That might be a meaningless number to some of your listeners, but 10 megabits is sufficient to watch video on the Internet, but it's not blazing fast. I can't watch HD video. I can't do teleconferencing in HD very easily. I can't send giant files back and forth to my office without problems, and especially when it comes to uploading content, the upload speeds are very slow, and the Internet is the first interactive communication system that we've ever had where you can become a content producer and not just a content consumer. So I think what you're getting overseas is about 5 to 10 times the speed for the same money, which is nothing to turn your nose up at. And second is all kinds of services and products that simply aren't available here because we don't have the networks to carry those things, you can get in Western Europe and in Asia.
Thank you very much for your call, Tony. You know, a lot of the local governments that have tried to own and operate their own broadband networks have had a hard time making a go of it. Where do you think municipal broadband should fit into a nationwide plan to expand broadband access, Jim?
Well, I think there's a place for it. We're certainly not hostile to it in any way at AT&T. I think as long as a municipality kind of draws the line and recognizes how they're using public funds because it's generally not considered fair play to use taxpayers' money to compete with the private sector. But I think where we're not able to get a broadband into a particular area, I think there's a place for that. I think there's a challenge that local governments face, though, if they make this sort of investment, and that is really going into the business there, learning to operate it, since it's not a particular skill set that most municipalities have, and then how you can afford to keep it up to date, because it requires constant investment and constant maintenance and upgrades in order to keep up with new innovations, things
like streaming video. A rapidly changing environment.
Exactly right.
What lessons, Ben, do you think an Obama administration can learn from the cities and towns that have tried launching their own broadband initiatives?
I think that there are a few things. One is we shouldn't discourage anybody from trying to offer a broadband service anywhere, no matter who they are. Whether they're a big company or a small company or a city or a nonprofit or just a community group putting antennas on top of their houses and sharing a wireless connection, broadband deployment is broadband deployment. We ought to support it. I think that's lesson number one. Lesson number two is you've got to bring technology to people. You can't just expect people to come to technology. And people are in different places in their lives. They need different things. And, you know, some people need a 100 megabit broadband connection that's the best in the world. And some people, you know, just check their email and, you know, look at a few newspaper articles online. They don't necessarily need that. And they're happy with, you know, the free Wi-Fi connection that they can get at the library. And, you know, some people are early in their life, in their interaction with technology, and they've just gotten their first computer. And maybe the city's wireless network for $5 a month is the right product for them. These are all things that ought to be encouraged, and we ought to find business models that work in each of these instances. And I think that you see that across the country. Municipalities in many areas have been very, very successful in delivering things to their citizens that have just not been available in the commercial marketplace.
Back to the telephones. Here's Lewis in Riverdale, Maryland. Lewis, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Gojo. I wanted to speak to the guy who had a dial-up and wanted to know what else you did with a high-speed internet.
Yes, that would be Terrence, the email, yes.
What, about 5 years ago when the Mars landers first got on Mars and we started getting pictures back?
Yes.
I was kind of like he was, you know, felt that email was all I used it for and was quite fast enough. While I was waiting for the pictures to come over from Goddard, which is, what, about 5 miles from where I live?
Yes.
I figured out that it took longer for the pictures to get from Goddard to my house than it did to get from Mars to Goddard. I got a DSL the next day.
Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing that with us, Lewis. Is it Lewis or is it Louis?
Either one.
Okay, thank you.
Whether you're my mother or not.
What does your mom call you?
Lewis.
Oh, well, in that case, we'll call you Louis. Okay.
All right. Thank
you very much for your call. Also, Dan, who wants to talk a little bit about broadband as it is compared to Japan. Dan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Kocho, thanks. I don't know if you recall, but a while back on Tech Tuesdays, when you had the guys on and they were talking about different computer systems and so forth, somebody asked about broadband. And one of those guys was telling everybody, which I checked into later on, that Japan has a broadband system that makes the United States look lame in comparison. I mean, we only have like 10% capacity compared to the Japanese.
Okay.
And the question was asked then, and I'm asking it now, why are we holding ourselves back? What's the problem? Why can't we have, if we're going to have this type of technology and we say we want to, you know, be the best in the world and be on top of things, what's holding us back regulation-wise that we can't have a competitive system that's on a par with these other countries?
Ben Scott?
Well, about 10 years ago, the Japanese made a plan, a national broadband plan, to put that network in the ground and to get ahead of the rest of the world in the infrastructure they had for internet services, and they have absolutely got the best network in the world. And I think here at home, we have a couple of issues to look at. One is, why isn't New York City just as wired as Tokyo? You know, they have similar characteristics in terms of the cost models for pushing those networks out. You know, and secondarily, you know, we have rural America that we have to deal with that the Japanese don't have quite so much of, and that's a different question. But I think you're absolutely right that we ought to set the bar high. Our aspirations ought not to be to build the network that's barely adequate for today. Our aspirations ought to be to build the network that is future-proof, that delivers all of the services and all of the advantages that are going to our global competitors.
Jim Ciccone?
I think that's spot on. In this country, I think we got a slower start in some respects than other countries because, frankly, some of the regulatory treatment was unclear. And I think companies that are thinking about investing the billions of dollars that would be required need certainty and clarity more than anything else. And I think 3 or 4 years ago, this was cleared up at the FCC. And I think you've seen rapid investment since then. So we did get a little bit of a late start. but we are catching up. The second point I'd make, and I think Ben alluded to this, is we do need a national broadband strategy in this country. It doesn't necessarily mean legislation, although it could. It doesn't necessarily mean particular regulations or deregulation, although it could. What it means is we set goals and objectives, we understand the problem, and we set ourselves some targets, and then we set about trying to solve it. We really haven't done that in this country. We badly need to, and it's one of the things that AT&T and Free Press actually recently and a lot of other people came together on and calling on the Obama administration to make a priority out of getting together a national broadband strategy for America.
Indeed, you are all part of a loose coalition trying to push the president to do this. It was the subject of an article in the Washington Post, if you go back to the issue of December 3rd, the week before President-elect Obama mentioned improving broadband access in his weekly address. It's a Tech Tuesday discussion about universal broadband access in the U.S. Feel free to call us, 800-433-8850, or to send an email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, how your definition of success affects your happiness. We look into why one-third of Americans report they're chronically dissatisfied with some aspect of their lives. Today at 1 on The Kojo Nnamdi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Next time on Tell Me More, the recession has been hitting just about every corner of the American economy. The big banks have been much in the news, but what about the little guys? With big banks laying off thousands, we ask how small and minority-owned banks are faring. We'll ask a top banking consultant. I'm Michelle Martin. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's on Tell Me More at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
This afternoon at 1 on WAMU's HD Channel 3, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say. This live, interactive program lets listeners participate in international conversations about current events. You can contact them for more information about getting your questions on the air at worldhaveyoursay.com. Click on Contact Us. That's World Have Your Say this afternoon at 1 on WAMU's HD Channel 3. Complete schedule information for HD Channel 3 is at WAMU.org.
Tonight at 6 on Marketplace, while some Eastern European countries have embraced capitalism, they've also been hit hard by the global market crisis. That story and the day's numbers on Marketplace tonight at 6. Now back to the Kojo Nnamdi Show.
We're discussing universal broadband access with Jim Sacconi, Senior Executive Vice President for External and Legislative Affairs with AT&T, and Ben Scott, Policy Director at Free Press, a nonpartisan organization advocating media reform and universal access to communications. Gentlemen, network neutrality. The idea that broadband network operators should be prohibited from creating special fast lanes on the Internet was part of Barack Obama's campaign platform. What kind of movement do you expect to see on this issue during his administration, Ben Scott?
Well, as a consumer advocate who's been at the head of the call for net neutrality rules for the last several years, when I heard President-elect Obama say that he's going to take a backseat to no one on net neutrality, I felt pretty good about that. And I think that we're likely to see movement on this issue and a resolution over the next 6 months. I really think that the last 3 years there's been a lot of heated debate over this question, but we've gotten to the place where it's no longer a question of if, it's a question of when, and the various principles have found a lot of common ground. People have receded from extreme positions, and we've got a proposal, I think, that will be introduced by the champions of net neutrality in the Congress next year that can move.
Jim Sacconi, according to a report in yesterday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, one of the biggest network neutrality supporters, Google, is quietly asking cable and phone companies for preferred treatment on their networks. What did you make of that story?
Well, they haven't asked us, so I take it with a grain of salt. Google was very quick in posting online a response to that. I do think that there's a big difference between net neutrality and the practice of caching content locally. I think everybody, regardless of which side you've been on the net neutrality debate, I think everybody agrees that the local caching is very acceptable. It doesn't create any harm to anybody. It doesn't harm consumers. It doesn't harm the other traffic in any way. It doesn't slow anything down. All it really does is speed up the traffic of the people that are doing the caching. So I don't see any particular issue
there. I don't
understand
what local caching means.
It basically means you're storing the content closer by the people who are accessing it. So it arrives faster and it's a very common practice.
What do you think of that Wall Street Journal story, Ben?
In short, I thought they got it wrong. I think that it's a complicated issue, and you know they thought they had something that was going to be a revelation, that Google was backing off on one of their signature issues, and Google said, no, we're not, and that's actually something completely different. You know, the way I look at it is, you know, if you live in Washington, you live anywhere near the Beltway like I do, and you call for pizza delivery, if you call the pizza delivery guy that's one exit away, he gets there faster than if you call the guy who's five exits away. But once they get on the Beltway to come to your house, they're on the Beltway, and they're subject to the same traffic that's on the Beltway. So, you know, what Google is doing is building their pizza delivery place closer to your house. But once they get on the Internet, there's no difference. And that's the neutral part. Neutral online just means your traffic on Beltway is treated like you're subject to it just like everybody else.
But your organization sponsored advertisements in about half a dozen newspapers this month asking for the chairman of the FCC to step down. What are your current grievances? What are your grievances with the current leadership?
Oh, we didn't ask for the current leadership to step down. We posted a help wanted ad. A help wanted ad because you know the new administration is coming in. The current chairman, Kevin Martin, will likely resign. That's historically what happens when the parties change hands in the White House. And we decided that rather than wait for the Obama administration to pick an FCC chair, we'd help them out by posting a help wanted ad in papers across the D.C. area. And we would put down some of the job characteristics that we felt would be suitable to the task. And, of course, you know, support for net neutrality was at the top of the list. And support for universal broadband was at the top of the list. So we were just giving them a little bit of a blueprint for how to go about their job search.
Okay. Let's go to Lisa in Fairfax, Virginia. Lisa, you're on the air with the man who's been giving advice to the president-elect. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. And I always learn something on Tech Tuesday. Great show.
Thank you.
Hey, I just have a quick testimony on the power of broadband. On 9/11, I was living up at Fort Meade, Maryland, and my husband was in the Pentagon. And when I finally got the phone call that he actually had survived, right after that, I lost all cell phone connectivity. I had no landline connectivity. I had nothing but my high-speed internet through cable. And I was able then to email my friend at West Point, who was able to call my husband's mother in Florida to say that he was indeed alive. And I always think if there's a true emergency like 9/11, the only communication I had was through the broadband.
Okay. Lisa, you underscored for a lot of people exactly how in an emergency situation broadband can be important. Contrast that, if you will, with the email we got from Harrison in Fairfax, who says, "With all due respect to the president-elect, promising to improve internet access is the modern-day equivalent of a student council candidate promising tastier lunches and extended recess hours to his or her classmates. Yes, everyone wants it. Yes, everyone says they're going to deliver it. But we need to ask ourselves what kind of sacrifices we're willing to make to get it. Personally, I think we're going to need to be willing to reconsider our entire electronic and telephone grids if we're going to do this. And I'm not sure people are ready for that yet." Jim Ciccone?
Well, I think that reconsideration has been ongoing. The internet has forced it. It really is in many ways year by year displacing a lot of the traditional means of communication and even entertainment that we've had. Everything is becoming IP enabled. In other words,
we're voting with our mice.
I think within within a matter of years, I think you'll find that both wireless communications and voice over IP really end up gradually displacing what the type of phone services and communication services a lot of people grew up with.
Allow me to go to Masood. I'm sorry, to Kenwin. Kenvin, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hello. I just heard a comment earlier, and I was tempted to just listen through, but I lost the will. I had to call the comment comparing the broadband ability in Japan compared to, say, the U.S., for example. I live and work in Japan. I'm just here on holiday, and I would argue that, first of all, I've never had a dropped phone call, and I've been there almost 4 years using my cell phone. I've never had a dropped phone call, and the Japanese government is solely behind and strictly behind, fully behind the development of the Internet, and they're supposed to be on the third level, if you will, of Internet technology. Compared to the U.S., where, I don't know what we're probably at the beginning of, but the fact is the Japanese government are the people who have backed this entirely. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're so far ahead. And except America, the U.S. government does the same thing. Mr. Obama seems to be inclined that way. Except we do the same thing, we'll never be anywhere close to Japanese technology. And then, by the way, that 75% of the Japanese people use the Internet. So that makes it even more of a demand.
Kenvin, did you say you've never had a dropped phone call in the 4 years you've been in Japan?
Never. It doesn't happen. No, I don't know anyone that has had a dropped phone call.
What is the going rate for the homes in your neighborhood? We're thinking of moving.
Allow me to have
Ben Scott talk a little bit about the level of government resolve that led to this in Japan.
Well, I think the last two callers have it exactly right. Look, we have a major challenge ahead of us. Let's not make any mistake about that. And I think we need bold leadership. And I think we need to make a major change about the way we thought about broadband infrastructure. Because let's be clear, there are all kinds of studies that show that every percentage point of American households that subscribe to broadband, and the caller mentioned that near 80% of the Japanese subscribe to broadband. That number is down in the 50s here in the United States. Every percentage point represents hundreds of thousands of jobs. That is exactly what we need at a time of economic recession. That is exactly the kind of jumpstart to our economy. We need to get back up to where the Japanese are, and that's going to require sacrifices. That's going to require a new direction. That's going to require setting aside this idea that somehow the best thing government can do in the broadband space is get out of the way. That's changing now. Now we're talking about how can government work with industry to make sure that we are headed down the path that the Japanese started down 10 years ago, but we're racing because we've got to catch up.
Jim?
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. There is a role for government here. It isn't just to get out of the way. I think Japan 10 years ago put a national broadband strategy into place. We need one. I think we recognize that the government has historically played a role in helping ensure universal service, in helping private investment deal with the challenges of rural areas, things of this nature. We need government to free up more spectrum for more wireless and wireless broadband services. So there is a role government can play here to help broadband deployment in this country.
Allow me to go to Dan in Herndon, Virginia. Dan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually a network engineer by trade, and I guess my concern is that a lot of this discussion has been focused on bandwidth as though it were, you know, the thing at the end of the rainbow that you scoop out of the pot that only the network providers have. But bandwidth at the end of the day is just interconnection. So what about a broadband deployment initiative that was more focused, just as when you're in your office, you have real fast connection to the other PCs in your office, more focused on a grid-style network layout instead of a top-down one?
Jim Saccone?
I think you're going to see a lot more experimentation with things of this nature, but I think there's a fundamental point here in our debate that we need to focus on. We do tend to talk in terms of bandwidth for the end user and getting a big pipe into each home. And I think I'm a non-engineer here, but I can tell you that no matter how big that pipe is, it's not gonna deliver the promised levels of speed unless the network itself and the internet backbones themselves can handle the traffic flow. The internet is often said to be a network of networks, and it's only as fast as the slowest handoff between these networks. We just finished a pretty massive multi-billion-dollar investment in our network just this summer to quadruple the capacity of our backbone, and this is just to keep up with the flow of network traffic over the next several years on the internet, a lot of that due to streaming videos. So we need to focus at both ends of this, not just the end user, but also the core network.
And
themselves.
I'm sure, Ben Scott, a lot of people are worried that with so many people using up bandwidth on broadband networks, how do we keep these networks from jamming up the same way our highways often do? What kind of investment would it require to build networks capable of handling the high-speed traffic of the future?
Well, I think that, you know, we know how fast the traffic on the internet is increasing. The business side guys and the engineers in the industry know how much bandwidth they need to put in their networks to make sure that it can handle the traffic. But I think Dan, the caller, has it exactly right, which is that we need to think about ways that we can communicate with one another over the internet that don't require, you know, me sending an email to you, Kojo, across the room that has to go to a server in New York before it gets across the room. There's no reason why we can't communicate back and forth to each other. There's no reason why here in the Washington, D.C. metro area, if we're sending a message across town or we're sending a file across town or we're making a phone call across town, there's no reason it has to go up to the internet backbone. We could create, this is where wireless and wired technologies can be very nicely integrated so that we have our own little local area network here where if you don't go out, if you're communicating within that network, you're not going up to the internet backbone. And the speeds that you can achieve in that local area network are off the charts and a really exciting proposition.
And I think I'm about to run out of time here. I wanted to get one quick issue in. And David, if you can say what you're going to say in 10 seconds or less, we're good to go.
Hello?
David, you got 10 seconds.
Okay, why aren't you looking at the new technologies that allow us to send the internet, phone, and TV over the power lines?
Over the power lines.
So that's a technology that has been experimented with for several years now and has always been heralded as just around the corner, and it never quite makes it.
And that's all the time we have. Ben Scott is Policy Director at Free Press, which is a nonpartisan organization advocating media reform and universal access to communications. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Ciccone is Senior Executive Vice President for External and Legislative Affairs at AT&T. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nnamdi Show, archaeologists find a treasure trove of history in Rock Creek Park, the surprising history of your jogging path and commuter shortcut, plus the skirmish that shut down Canada's government, why the parliament disbanded, and what Americans need to know about the next prime minister. The Kojo Nnamdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the German Embassy and German Information Center. NASA.